Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I'm joined today once again by my good friend, Nadia Cater. How are you, Nadia?
Great. How are you, Mike?
I'm very good. I'm very excited to talk about this movie. This is my favorite kind of movie because I did not know it existed. And then I watched it and was like, whoa, this is great. And then went online and the world was like, yeah, this is a great movie. You didn't know about this? And I was like, I didn't know about this.
Yes, I've wanted you to watch this movie for years.
Really?
Like, literally years. Yeah. I was like, oh man, this is the movie Mike would really grasp onto. Like, Mike needs to see this. You should see other Satoshi Kon movies. Like, we'll get into it, but yeah.
So yeah, we're talking today about the 1997 anime film, Perfect Blue, directed by what's his name?
Satoshi Kon.
Kon?
Mm-hmm.
Satoshi Kon. Satoshi Kon. Written by Sadayuki Morai. Based on a book by Yoshikazu Takuchi. I might be saying a lot of that wrong. The book is called Perfect Blue, Complete Metamorphosis. The same director remade it in 2002 as a live-action film.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I've not seen that. And this movie was highly influential on Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan, which you could see that a lot. You could see a lot of Black Swan in this. And so tell us a little bit about Perfect Blue. What's it about?
So it's about a pop idol. She's part of a pop group, right? Her name is Mima. And she decides that the idol world is stifling and she wants to get out of it. So it's all about her trying to get out of it, move into acting, but also having this struggle internally with how she has to change her public image as well as be okay with kind of darker content. Because pop idols, though they are sexualized in a way, they're also almost sanitized.
Yeah.
Too. So it's kind of like, I hate saying this, but I've seen this in like America too, like sexy baby almost kind of. Or sexy little girl. It's like
born sexy yesterday is the trope. Born sexy yesterday.
Oh, okay.
I'm dumb, but I'm still a sexual object to you.
Yeah. Maybe naive. Maybe not dumb, but like naive.
Right. Like, naive.
Yeah. Born innocent.
Yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. We use the term pop idol in America, but it's very specific in Japan. I mean, pop idols are like, it's like royalty. Like, maybe the closest thing we have to, like, pop idols are, like, maybe Disney Channel stars. They become, like, they always have, like, an album where they sing, and, like, you know what I mean? Like, they're models, they're cute, everyone loves their innocence, but at the same time, people are aware that they're attractive. It's that kind of thing. And the group in this movie, they in the beginning, they're a group of three pop idols called, what are they called? Cham, C-H-A-M. And all three are dressed in kind of like different color schoolgirl outfits.
Yeah. There's also like a kind of, I don't know if they'd call it this, but there's almost like a morality clause.
Yeah.
With pop idols, like similar to Disney stars, right?
Yeah.
They can't really be seen like as any kind of adult-ish, right? I remember anecdotally the actor who played the older brother on Hannah Montana, actually, or the friend, one of those, he got his ears pierced. But because that is kind of like an older kid thing, even though this guy was like in his late teens or 20s, he had to grow his hair out so that to cover his pierced ears, right?
Wow.
And that Disney thing that you connected is really interesting, because pop idols in Japan also, like, they're not allowed to date. They're not allowed to, like, show any kind of, if they have sex.
Yeah. Right.
So there's a lot of like, it is innocent in a way, but it's also like very, like they're very controlled by whoever holds their contract.
Right. And the fact that they're not allowed to date is almost like to foster the fantasy that some people take too far. Like, she doesn't have a boyfriend, so she could be your girlfriend. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because this film features a stalker who is obsessed with Mima, who we see throughout the film. Mima's our lead character. It begins with, like, they're at, like, some, like, festival or some... It actually begins... Remember, this is 1997. It begins with a Super Sentai, like, parody. The Power Rangers parody. Where you see, like, these Super Sentai Power Rangers, like, running around. And then you see, like, it's like a fair. Like, there are kids watching it. And her group, Cham, are going to play the fair. And one interesting thing that's a motif throughout the film is there'll be these crowd scenes where you hear people just talking about the lead character as through what they know from, like, the gossip magazines and things like that. Like, oh, did you hear she's going to leave the group? Did you hear they, like, she doesn't want to do this anymore. She wants to be an actress now. And, like, that keeps repeating throughout the sort of, like, Greek chorus of the, you know, the viewers, the audience, like, repeats throughout the film, which I think is really interesting.
And I also want to note that when they're at this fair, and even whenever she's surrounded by people, they're almost all men.
Yes.
Even the kind of pop idol-ish kind of songs, you would think it would skew younger, like younger girls.
Right.
But it's all dudes, like older dudes. Adult men watching and judging and making these, like you said, like this Greek chorus kind of thing. It's really unsettling because it's like you're in the chorus of the voyeurs, right?
Yes.
They're there for the men. It's creepy.
It's totally a movie about the idea of the male gaze and what it means to be a female in a male gaze society, because when she's a little pop star, all these, you know, creeps are obsessed with her. But then when she tries to become a more mature actress, almost to, like, punish her, like, the producers and writers of the show she's on, like, are like, oh, you want to do more? You want to bother me for more scenes? Well, how about a rape scene then? And all of a sudden, God, she's like this violent rape object, which then makes her original audience mad. It's sort of like, it shows how, like, we get obsessed with people and we want them. They're either, you know, it's either like the virgin or the Madonna or the whore. You know what I mean? Like, and that's what that's what we're watching. We're seeing this normal woman go from a virgin character that's not the real her to, like, a whore character, and just everyone mad at her and everyone looking at her.
Yeah. Also not the real her either, because throughout this whole movie, we never see her on a date. We never see her talk to anybody outside of, because this is her role outside of this, the producers that she works with or her agents. Right. Like, she doesn't have friends. She doesn't have friends. She doesn't have a relationship with anybody. Really.
Her best friend. It's like she's alone. Yeah. Her best friend is Maury, the like assistant to her manager.
Yeah, which right. But even then, it's like that person has a role, right?
Right.
We could spoil. No, well, actually, I was just talking in general about
It's her job.
It's her job.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's not really her friend. And no. I mean, spoiler alert, she is, turns out, the secret antagonist with this whole movie.
Yeah.
That we'll get into. But it's kind of obvious. But anyway, it's like she's so alone. And I think in that sense, I don't know if that's really talking to the entertainment industry or maybe even Khan's, like, because he's male, he didn't even think about women's relationships, because it's not about women's relationships. It's not so much about Mima as how people view her and how she's trying to get out of getting put in these boxes. But that's just like her being in the entertainment industry. She's kind of stuck in that. There's great point where the first time we introduced to the stalker, right? Like he looks creepy. He has like these almost fish eyes that are like in different directions.
A deformity in his face.
Yeah.
Problematic you know, to because there's some problematic things in this, like his deformity and then Maury's weight is
right.
They make her look grotesque for being overweight.
I thought her name was Rumi. It's Maury. Rumi, or...
right. It's Rumi. It's Rumi.
Okay. Yeah. Something. Sorry. But he's holding, when he's watching, like, and people are being shitty to him, like the other audience members are being gross to him. But while he's watching the show, he actually holds up his hand and how he's faced in a way. And at first, you don't see what he's looking at or why he has his hand up. And you're like, that's kind of weird. But then the camera cuts to his point of view, and it's like Mima is in his hand, like performing for him because of how far he is.
Yeah.
And he's just like getting pleasure from that. He's just enjoying having her, like having her quote.
Yeah.
And that's just something so, again, so creepy and so objectifying throughout this whole movie.
Yeah. And he's like, to go into like the traditional theories of like the male gaze in cinema studies, like a lot of times he's filming her with a camcorder, even though like he's obsessed with her and he's right in front of her, he'd still rather look at her through the device and capture her that way. And it's so interesting that like he a lot of also what this movie about is technology, like how technology sort of captures females and removes their agency. The internet also in this is a way in which she is being observed and controlled. And the industry, the she's on a drama TV show. So you constantly see those cameras and those producers like kind of controlling her.
Yeah. Yeah. It does happen a lot. It kind of, in a weird way, it reminded me of that movie from the 60s in Britain. Was it Peeping Eye, Peeping Tom?
Peeping Tom,
Peeping Tom, where the murderer has to look at women through his camera.
Yeah.
And, like, that's how he kills women, is, like, with the camera.
Yeah.
Like, he can't look at them, and it's so hard for him to be around them and to communicate with them unless it's through the camera. And then when it's through the camera, he stabs them with the camera leg, right?
Right,
kind of like that in a weird way, where it's like Mima needs to be seen through technology. And you talked about internet, and I kind of forgot that there was a time period where a young person wouldn't really understand how to use a computer.
Yeah.
Because it's 1997. That's when this movie came out. So it was being made in like 95, 96. So internet was around, but it wasn't, you know, there were still pockets of population that never used the internet, never used a computer.
Right.
So in that case, right. So that's a possibility. And Mima's actually pretty young. She's like, what, in her late teens, 20 years old, something like that.
Yeah.
And so she gets some message, some note, handed to her after her last show. She announces she's leaving the group, right? And she doesn't look at it until later, but when she does, it says, "I love seeing Mima's room," or something like that.
Which is very creepy.
Which she didn't know what it was. And then it turns out that it's an internet site that someone put up where they're just outlining everything she does as if they're her. So she's like, like a diary. Yeah.
It's a blog. It's a diary, right? But it's written in her voice, but she's not writing it. When she first gets the letter, she's like, "In my room, they're watching me in my room." And what's interesting is, despite the fact that she's like a pop idol, there's no indication that she's wealthy or even well to do at all. She lives in like a tiny little apartment,
little shitbox apartment. Yeah.
Yeah, she lives in like a little shitbox apartment. Like, there's a great shot where she's in her apartment. And then she's all alone. And then she has a fax machine. Okay. It's the 90s, folks. So she has a fax machine and she starts to get a fax. And on the fax, written all over it, is "traitor, traitor, traitor." Because at the show, in the beginning of the film, she announces to her audience, "Hey guys, I'm leaving the group to go follow my dreams as an actress." So it's like, that's why. So it's "traitor, traitor." And so she realizes whoever this person is like, has her fax number. And she turns her head and looks out her window, and you see like a long shot from, I mean, it's not a camera because it's animation, but the virtual camera is very, very far away. And the whole composition is like the bluish dark gray of the nighttime, and just one little red box of her window. And she's just like, she's looking at it. She feels again, like trapped, and like anybody could look at me. I'm completely this tiny little thing in this tiny page. It's very
It's actually a zoom out composition. Yeah. And I always think when they use that in animation, that's really fun.
Yeah.
Because it's playing with our perception of like you said, virtual, like I use the term like framing and stuff like that because, but it's animation. It's there isn't really a camera that we're following, a video camera, but it's made to look like it. Right.
It's still using the cinematic language.
And I
actually the cinematography, you know, the virtual cinematography in this film is extraordinary. I mean, what it does with its compositions, what it does with lighting and color and design, like it's absolutely like, it's not just gorgeous, but it's all sort of meaningful. It all tells its story in this great way. And its editing is fantastic. This movie has this great trick that it does a lot where one thing transitions to another and you're kind of disoriented into what time and place you are. Like she's talking to some person and you think she's talking, and then someone else will say something. You'd be like, well, that person wasn't there. And then you realize she's in a completely different scene. And it's like, it's kind of her disorientation, but also our disorientation.
Yeah. That's, so have you ever seen a Satoshi Kon film outside of this?
No.
Yeah, so I've seen a couple of them. I didn't see all of them. He unfortunately died in 2010, I will say.
Okay.
Of bladder cancer or pancreatic cancer, something like that.
Oh,
so geez. He only made a couple of films. And I've seen, this is like the third one I've seen. And he does this repeatedly in, there's another film about an actress too that's wildly different called Millennium Actress. Mm-hmm. And it kind of takes you in these moments where you think you're, when she's talking about her movies and you like think she's talking about a movie, but then it's like a part of her real life. And they do the same thing in Paprika, which is about a scientist who has an alter ego that can go into people's dreams. And again, it's the same thing. You're going from dream to real life. And Satoshi Kon really likes playing with that. And he does this a lot throughout his stuff.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of the writer Murakami. Like his novels are a little bit like that.
I've never actually read Murakami.
I only read one that was, I can't even really tell you what it was about, but it has that feeling of like, one thing sort of seeps into another. Also, I'd say that Black Swan, the Darren Aronofsky film, which I believe Darren Aronofsky has said, like, oh yeah, I was very much influenced by Perfect Blue. Like, he hasn't denied it. Like, does that a lot, where one thing leads into another thing and you kind of don't ever know where you are in time and space.
Yeah, actually, the movie Inception.
Yeah.
Yeah, directed by Nolan. Similar thing. There's a scene, I don't know if you remember Inception, but where like the floor kind of gets wavy.
Yeah.
And then they kind of, that's taken directly from Satoshi Kon's Paprika. There's a scene where a character is in a hotel and he's running down a hallway and then everything kind of melts and he falls into something else. So Satoshi Kon's films are very like, people take from them and people know about him.
Yeah.
And the fact that they did an animated set, that's what blows my mind, is like he really plays with animation in a way that really just challenges your perceptions of what animation can do.
Yeah.
And I think I just really, especially with the Perfect Blue, even though the character design seems very outdated and kind of, at sometimes I kind of like forgot who was who because they all kind of looked very similar.
Yeah.
But like the cinema, like I said, you know, like you said, the cinematography is really interesting. The transitions are really interesting.
Yeah. The color red is a big motif in this. We see red a lot. We don't see blue a lot. As a matter of fact, I'll be honest with you and say, I don't understand the title.
I don't either.
Perfect. I don't understand it. But you do see red a lot. So I was saying to you the other day when we were talking about this a little bit through text, there's one big flaw with this, which is you can guess the ending almost immediately.
Yeah.
She has this stalker who is obviously following her, and you don't know in the beginning whether he's in her imagination or real. But Rumi, the woman who is like her only friend and who is the assistant to her manager, she says early, she's Every time the manager wants to like do something with her, she's against it. She's like, why does she need, she should keep singing. Why does she need to act? When he's like, she's going to do a rape scene. She's like, oh no, she can't do that. And we also learned that she, when she was younger, was a pop idol and grew out of it. So really early on, you're like, oh, this woman's the bad guy. This woman's behind it. And that ends up inevitably being what happens. But I don't think it takes away from my enjoyment of the film.
So I do have a question for you, because I was thinking about it too. It is obvious, but was it obvious in 1997? Because is this something that this kind of like twist trope was that?
I think it would have been. I do think it would have been. Honestly, if I had to fix it, I would maybe take out the dialogue about her being a pop idol, because that really hits it on the nose. I would maybe if you remove that line, it would all seem a little bit. And also the fact that everything Mima's gonna do, she's against. And it's like, why would you're the manager. Like, why would your management team, one part of your management team, be totally against everything you're trying to do?
Right. Which do you think it would have been helpful if she was like, I don't know, like Mima's momager or something, like mom manager?
I thought she was in the beginning. I was like, oh, is that her mom?
Because she is very kind of protective of her in a way, too, you know? And her parents apparently live far. Like, she talks to her mom on the phone, like, once. And it seems like they live far away from her. And that's, like, her only kind of just catching up with them.
Yeah.
Is just telling them what's going on. And then they keep track of her, like, her singles and stuff, right?
Yeah.
But maybe if it was a family member and that family member is uncomfortable with sexual violence stage and stuff like that, maybe that would make sense.
Yeah.
Or maybe if we never knew who it was. What if it was just, it could have been anybody? I think that would have been just as interesting. If we just saw that, I keep wanting to call her Paprika, but if we could see that Mima constant changing, because you do see that over time.
Yeah.
Switching between Rumi and that fake Mima, or that mirror Mima, whatever you call it.
Right. There comes a point where Mima's sort of identity begins to sort of crack, and she starts seeing in her reflection and just seeing appear before her her image, not the real her, but her image of Mima the pop idol. And she's like naive and giggly and wearing the outfit, and actually like bounces around like a little anime girl.
That was kind of terrifying the first time you see that.
Yeah,
because she's like on the subway being kind of freaked out that there's this blog out about her, and it's just, the blog is detailing like very specific details of her life.
So she knows, so at first, watched.
Yeah, because at first it's almost like, oh, this is almost like if I did it. And then she was reading it and it's like, I stepped out of the train with my left foot instead of my right foot. And you're like, what?
Wow. Yeah.
And she's like kind of worried and kind of creeping out about it, because she's on the subway. She's like, okay, that means that someone's going to see me get off the subway. And then her reflection changes to the pop idol Mima.
Right.
And it talks to her.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was creepy as hell.
Yeah, yeah. And she's scared whenever she's in public. She's scared because she feels like somebody's watching me. Somebody's always watching me.
And you know what's the most upsetting about this movie that they don't quite address is that every time something happens around her and she's scared, all the other people around her kind of like push off her fears. They're like, no, don't worry about it. It's fine. Right. Or yeah, you're good. Just do what you have to do. And it's almost like they're kind of infantilizing her in a way.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, absolutely.
Yeah, because so on set, when she's, you know, playing this character, the her manager, I believe, Mr. Takadoro, or Roku, or whatever, Tadaroko, is, there's like an explosion or a gunshot. And it looks like he was harmed by like a letter bomb. And she's kind of freaked out about it. And she's like, should we call the police? And everyone's like, no, we don't want to do that. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Right, right.
It was just like a prank. And I'm like, a prank? The guy got harmed.
I know. Yeah, I know. It's.
And the same thing with the blog, too, when she points out, and of course, it turns out Rumi is writing the blog, right? Obviously.
Right.
But she points out to Rumi, like, yeah, someone's writing about me. And Rumi's like, yeah, don't worry about it. People get, you know.
Yeah, she's weird. Gaslit. She's gaslit constantly.
That's the word. Yes. It's constant gaslighting before that term was just used regularly now, right?
Right.
And well, like we look for the signs.
It became very famous when we had a president of America who was a gaslighter. And then the term became like very well known. But yeah, that's been around for a while. But yeah, she's gaslit. Like you think, okay, she's famous, so she must have handlers, but they're not yes men. They are really controllers of her. She does at some point do a rape scene, which is she thinks is going to help her career. But really, she doesn't want to do it. She agrees to do it for the manager because she feels like they've helped me so much. They've got so much invested in me. But she, you know, when she after the scene is over, she comes home and cries and was like, I didn't really want to do it. So
she breaks down real hard.
Yeah. And that's a hard scene too.
Oh, because it's so long. It like keeps going.
Yeah.
And even like when the director is like, no, start again. The actor who's supposed to be like raping her, and he's like, no, stay there. So he has to be like on top of this young woman.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm so sorry. And it's so awful.
Yeah.
Because it's basically a gang rape. Like, so
yeah, it's wild.
Let's set it. Like she plays a stripper in this show that they, at first she just had one line and then they gave her like, okay, you want more.
Yeah.
We're going to make you like this recurring character for a couple episodes or something.
The show is called Double Bind. And it's, I think of it as like Law and Order SVU because it looks like a procedural in some way. Right.
Yeah. And it's about like these two cops that solve psychological, like thriller kind of cases, like sickos, right? Yeah. Like serial killers and stuff. So she plays a stripper. So she's stripping on stage. And then there's all these, again, another motif, all these men around her, right? I mean, of course, in this case, they're
leering at her, watching her.
Yeah. And then they like one of them gets on top, like grabs her. And then like the whole audience around that stage is holding her down while they simulate this rape scene for the show. And it's brutal.
Yeah.
Like she's screaming and crying. And of course she's acting like, and we're reminded of this, but it's still hard to watch.
Yeah.
And it goes on for like 2 minutes too long.
Right. Right.
It's brutal. It's pretty brutal.
And it's emblematic of her whole career. I mean, her whole career is adult men leering at her. And, you know, maybe now, and at this point with the rape scene, you know, maybe their fantasy is coming true, but they're going to hate her for it because that's just the way repression works. Like, you know, like her stalker, you think her stalker would love the fact that, like, at some point later on, she does nude photos for, like, a famous, like, photographer who's you know gets all the famous people to take their clothes off and you think her stalker would be you think her stalker would love this, like, okay, naked images of this person I'm obsessed with, but no, it like breaks his heart and drives him even crazier. He's like, no, this, you're not the real Mima. The real Mima is innocent. She would never do this.
Yeah, it's all about the fantasy. It's all tied up with the image, not with, you know, who this person can be. Right that photographer scene was a lot. I didn't think we'd see as much as we did, but yeah, you see everything.
You see
pubic hair, you see nipples. And the stalker actually is so upset by it, he goes to a newsstand and buys all of the copies of this naked Mima pictures to prevent people from seeing it. Like, he's upset. He keeps them piled up in his creepy little room that has all those pictures of Mima around.
Yeah.
But he doesn't look at them. That's what's interesting, exactly what you said. It's like it tarnishes his image of her.
Yeah.
So he keeps all the magazines piled up, but he doesn't look at them. But he has all those other pictures of her clothed.
One of the creepiest scenes is we see that he's the one running the blog, and we see him typing and speaking as he types, but it's her voice coming out of his mouth. And it's super unsettling, super creepy. But again, it means like she don't even have a voice. It's like her everything's taken from her. She's not allowed to have a voice. She's not allowed to have anything. Everything that is her corporeal being is controlled by other people or men. Or you think men until the very end, it's Rumi. Although Rumi, really, her psychosis comes from the fact that she grew out of being a pop star. She became older and was no longer that image. And that, like, made her snap.
Right. It's like she couldn't. She had to create this kind of facade of being the producer, assistant, or manager, or whatever her role is.
Right.
But that personality was her. So even that is that image of the agent or the assistant is false too.
Yeah,
because she
yeah.
needs to be the idol, right?
Yeah.
That's what she needs to be.
And she wants to be Mima specifically. She like becomes Mima in her mind. It reminds me a little bit of another 90s sexual thriller, Single White Female. Have you seen that?
No, I didn't.
It's about this woman who, it's called Single White Female because this is back when they were like want ads, and she's looking for a roommate. So she puts in the newspaper looking for single white female roommate. And this roommate comes and she seems normal at first, but then the roommate starts like dressing like her and makes her hair like her and like tries to fuck her boyfriend. And like it, the 90s had a lot of these like sexual psychological thrillers like Basic Instinct and Disclosure and Single White Female. This was like a big thing in the 90s. And this kind of goes along with that.
Yeah, it's very in the times, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like I feel like now it would be kind of harder to have this kind of movie or like in this way.
Well, people
like wouldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, go on.
I would say, I think people would, given our sort of more contemporary sensibilities, I think a lot of people would seize on the problematic elements of it. Like, why does the stalker have to be, you know, have an atypical body? Why does the main villain have to be an overweight woman who they accentuate her overweightness to almost like comedic things, like that's her problem. Like if she weren't overweight, maybe she wouldn't have lost her mind.
Yeah. And especially the rape scene too. I think that would also
be
shown that way.
It's one of these things that happens a lot where it's like, it kind of has a feminist message, but it also is not completely clear and perfect with its message, or it's clear with its message, but the way it goes about its message falls into other wrong-headed ways of thinking that were part and parcel of that contemporary time. Like, like it's about how this character is, her agency is taken away by the men who control her career and the men who control the media around her. But it's not very positive that the villain is a woman who wants that control and lost it, and therefore she went crazy and became a killer. You know, that's a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's intentional too, is that what's happening mirrors the show that Mima's guest starring on.
Sure. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Like the dissociative identity disorder victim who is also a killer, and there's also a killing spree happening. Cause at the same time, whoever like forces Mima to do something that's outside the pop idol image is murdered. And that's like happening alongside, and Mima is not totally aware of it.
Yeah.
Until later on in the movie.
Yeah.
Until like the stalker that she, spoiler, she kills the stalker.
Yeah.
Because he's egged to kill her because he thinks she's the fake Mima. And the pop idol image is like taunting him and saying, go get the real, you know, I'm the real
Rumi
one.
Rumi is writing him as Mima. Rumi is like, I'm the real Mima. You have to kill the other one. She sort of plays him.
Yeah, but that's what's creepy about it, is because it's also in Mima's pop idol voice too.
Yeah, yeah.
So and you also see her, like you see her reflection. And when he's reading the messages, all the Mimas around him in the pictures are talking.
Oh
too.
Yeah,
they're moving their mouths around, and that's so creepy. It plays with your perception too of like, is this really happening?
Yeah,
or is this what he or because it doesn't seem like he's totally aware of it.
Yeah, yeah. He's definitely, I mean, both villains are delusional, but he's more delusional because it allows Rumi to like use him, because she kind of sets him up to be the scapegoat. I just want to say there, I'm just looking at my notes. There's a great shot where she knows she's being watched outside. So she runs off the train and up the platform and outside, but then she stops and she's in front of an electronics store, and in the window of the electronics store are camcorders connected to TVs. So she turns and looks, and all the TVs in the storefront are her image with the cameras toward her. And it's like this perfect, like she's being watched constantly. Her eyes are never not on her and on her body.
Yes. Oh, it's so creepy. Yeah, I'm looking at my notes too. It's just, it's constant. Like, in a sense, though, that puts us in the voyeur position too. We're watching
Sure.
her be watched. We're watching her feel like she's losing her mind.
Yeah, I mean, in the film, she's a pop idol. But I think you could also say that in some ways, she's a metaphor for the anime girl. Because this is an anime film, and the anime girl is very much the same archetype as the pop idol girl. I'm young, I'm innocent, I've got the perfect, the quote-unquote perfect body. I'm so light as a feather, I bounce around and I just giggle, and oh, I'm so glad to have a man like you. I mean, you know, the Mima image, which she it isn't even really, like, there's no, that's not real either, is to me like a perfect, it's like an anime girl.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I also think there's a lot of duality here too.
Yeah.
Because like there's a lot of that doubling that gets played up a lot in this. Like when she comes home and her fish are dead, except
yeah.
for two. It's like there's two Mimas that she's struggling to be, the pop idol Mima and getting into the adult actress Mima. And
yeah.
She's constantly like struggling between that transition.
Yeah, that duality is all over. At the very end, she thinks she's in, when we have the reveal that Rumi is the mastermind villain, she thinks she's in her room, but she realizes there are little details that have changed, like the fish are alive. And then she realizes like it's not her room, it's a room made up to look like her room.
Yeah, like her old poster is still up, which very, you know, like memorably in the beginning of the movie, she takes down her Cham poster as a symbolic kind of gesture that she's leaving the group. And then so the Cham poster's up. She's like, why is this still up? Why are the fish alive? She looks outside and it's a different view than her room. And then she's like, I'm not in my room.
Right.
And then it's like Rumi's made an apartment that looks exactly like hers. That's so creepy. And then she's just chasing, and oh man, the chase scene at the end was really almost heart-stopping, because she almost gets caught a few times. And you see, and what's really weird is that you see, so Mima like jumps out the balcony and actually falls into like the street. So you always think she's about to die.
Yeah.
Even though she's the main character, like she can't really die, I guess. Maybe, I don't know. But so as she's being chased, and you see she's being chased by pop idol Mima, who's, you know, not running as fast as she is and just kind of gliding and hopping along. But then when you see the reflections as she's passing buildings and passing, you know, like mirror or whatever, you see it's actually Rumi like struggling to catch up with her, like running really hard.
Right. So, because and in scenes like that, you're like, who is this? Who is this? Whose image is this fantasy? Is this in Mima's mind? Or is this in Rumi's mind, you know, this fake Mima, you know?
And that's played with throughout the whole movie, too. It's like, we don't know if the delusion is shared or what. And that's not answered. And Satoshi Kon does do that in his other movies, too. It's like, you don't know what whose point of view you're seeing. It kind of messes up with it. Is there any like particular scene or shot or like theme or something that really stuck out at you in this movie?
Oh my God. There's a scene that it was incredible. So there's a scene toward the end of the film where Mima has really kind of gone off the deep end and she's really losing time. She doesn't know where she is and things keep transitioning back and forth. And she's really kind of becoming, you know, dissociated because of her anxiety and everything that's happening to her. And she has PTSD from filming the rape scene. There's a scene where she's in her room and then you see two people looking at her through a two-way mirror into her room. And they're like, oh yeah, so she still thinks she's some pop star named Mima who wants to be an actress. She thinks that the rape she endured was actually a rape scene in a show she's filming. And they fooled me. I was like, oh shit, like, is this really what they're gonna do? Or are they gonna say like she, like, this is all, everything we've seen has been in her head? But then it fucks you again, it pulls back and you see that that's the show. It's the show that she's acting in, and it's her character in the show. And and you see it played back again, but the only difference is they don't say Mima, they say the character's name.
Yeah.
But her character in the show is basically going through what she's going through. There's this whole part towards the end where it's like, is this real? Is it not? Is she filming the show? Is she not? Who are they really talking about? And it's that scene got me so hard because I fell for it. I totally fell for it.
Oh yeah, that was a bait and switch. That was so good. Mine is something like really small. Just when she's in her apartment and she knows that the photographer is dead and she's kind of bugged out about it.
Yeah.
And you also notice that the people that are murdered, their eyes are all like missing or bloody. Like it's like they were, you know, like they're preventing the voyeur thing from happening.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But she's in her closet. She goes in her closet and there's just bloody clothes there.
Yeah.
And she's like, for a second, she wonders if she's the killer. But then these people like jump out, like reporters jump out from like the side of the closet and they're like, are you the killer? Are you, or something like that? And she's just so overwhelmed that she turns and leaves and then it changes.
Right.
And it's like, that didn't happen.
Right.
And not that it's different in a way. I didn't expect like the reporter thing to be real so much as like, was the clothes real? Was Rumi putting the clothes there to mess with her, did Mima feel guilty that she was one of the last few people that photographers saw alive, and were they murdered because of her, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just so weird, and you don't get that answer. You don't really know like what's like I said, like you don't really know if her delusions are delusions or Rumi's messing with her.
Right. Right. Let's talk about everyone who's killed. So you said the photographer's killed. The writer of the TV show is killed because he wrote the rape scene. He's killed in an interesting way. He's like in a parking lot and he hears one of her pop songs like in the distance. And he's like in an underground parking lot. And then an elevator opens and there's a little like boombox playing her song. And then we don't see what happens, but then we see another floor, the elevator opens, and he's just dead in there, and there's blood everywhere, and his eyes are removed.
That was freaky.
Yeah,
that was so freaky.
And the manager gets killed at some point.
The manager gets killed. Mima kills her stalker. Who else?
But that's a great scene, too, because the stalker goes after her, and she struggles with him and kills him. And he dies on they're in the set of the gentleman's club. So like it's where the fake rape happened. So, and then she kills him. And then you're like, okay, she killed the bad guy. And then the director goes, okay, cut. And then everyone claps and you're like, oh shit, was this the show too? And I don't think it is. I think she's just in her mind. She imagines it as part of the show, but that really happens because we see his body later.
Right. She runs to find somebody. And you know, the creepiest thing about this movie is whenever she's in trouble, there's like no one around or there are people in the distance and they're not paying attention. And it's like, it's like her constantly being surveilled and people watching her are like not, it's almost like another layer of, again, this is not for her at all.
Yeah.
And not here to help her. She runs and gets room. Yeah, she's the object. She runs to get Rumi, tells her what happens, like the stalker, which by the way, the stalker attempted to rape her. And it makes me think that the reason why the stalker could do that was because in his mind, she wasn't the real Mima.
Yes.
So he could use her physically in the sense that he couldn't tarnish real, you know, Mima. Anyway, she goes to get Rumi and they go back and he's gone. And so you're also wondering as the audience member, did this happen? And then it cuts to backstage and there's the the manager's dead body on top of like the stalker's dead body. Like, so it's they're just throwing bodies.
Right, right.
It's almost like a horror movie.
Yeah, it is. Even though there are scenes with the stalker by himself, it still was a long time in the film before I was sure that he was real. Because she kept seeing him everywhere and I was like, is he real or is he, she's imagining him?
I wondered if he was real because in the beginning he gets into like a fight with the other gross men or like a altercation. But yeah, you can also argue that maybe she saw him one time and then just keeps, you know, in her brain kept seeing him. It doesn't mean he wasn't actually there.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know. Yeah.
So how does this film fit into the oeuvre of this filmmaker?
I think it's very common. I think he hits a lot of the same themes, just very differently. And he's not as bleak as the entertainment industry in Millennium Actress as he is in this movie. Like in this movie, in this movie, it's very clear that the entertainment industry is, you know, dark and awful. Millennium Actress is about this actor who has left film for decades. And she was this kind of like almost Japanese sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
And these two men who are like they're trying to record an interview with her because she's never allowed interviews before, and for some reason closer to the end of her life she allows an interview.
Uh-huh.
So they go to interview her, and the men interview her and she talks about her life in the Japanese film industry for decades, like over the years it changes, they're transported into her movies. Mm-hmm. But the thing is weird about it is like she's telling the story, but it's like they're actually there. Like they could get hurt. Okay. They can interact with people in the movie. It's very weird. And it just goes through her life and like what's happened to her, which again, it doesn't always seem like she has agency, but she's not tortured like Mima is.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is about, and it's about also Japan changing over time. So like there's like her pre-war movies and then her war movie post-war. So they do some really interesting stuff differently, like with animation, like the way it looks like a film sometimes, and then sometimes it looks like a real scene, like reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Paprika, it's about there's this scientist who goes into people's dreams using an alter ego called Paprika. Uh-huh. So she just becomes a different person.
Okay.
And Paprika goes into
protagonist in his films.
There's another movie that he done called Tokyo Godfathers, which is actually about two men in a, I think they use the term drag queen or crossdresser, but it's like a trans woman.
Okay.
So, and that one's different. I haven't seen it. But in these three movies, they have that similar kind of woman and dual role thing. Okay. Because in Millennium Actress, it's the actor as the person, but then it's the actor as the actor. And in Paprika, it's the scientist and her alter ego. So Paprika like goes into dreams and she helps try to solve whatever problem there is. And the overlying theme is that there is a dream that's acting as a like a disease or an illness, and it's actually infecting people and killing them. So she has to go into these dreams and find out what this dream is and how it's hurting people and where it came from.
Oh, okay. I got to see more of his films. This was just, I saw this because I was scrolling through Shudder. And by the way, it's definitely a thriller and it definitely has violence, but it's interesting to me that it's on Shudder. Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know, because Shudder is like, even though they do advertise and like most of their library are horror films, but they also fit into different kinds of horror. And that's like sometimes the horror of being. And that is, in this case, the horror of being in the entertainment industry. Even though it is a psychological thriller, there's still horror elements in it.
Yeah, for sure there are horror.
So, and I also think, like, I don't know if you noticed lately, but there it seems like their library has gotten a little better lately. I don't know if that.
Yeah. But
definitely more interesting and esoteric films.
For sure. Yeah, it was. I guess when I saw it on Shudder, I liked it a lot, but it wasn't what I expected when I turned it on. I thought it was gonna be bonkers. I don't know. I thought it was gonna be real, just like blood and guts kind of. I don't know. I guess I think of Shudder as like slashery, even though they've got more than slashers, but they certainly do have quite a library of slashers. They call them slashics.
Yeah, they have a lot of slashics, but it does look like they're trying to expand it. Because, I mean, yeah. They have some weird stuff on there too. Like, it's still in the horror vein, but they have that movie, The Old House, which is a classic closed room. It's about like this couple that kind of like their car breaks down. So they have to go to this creepy old castle and they're just stuck for the night with these really creepy people. Yeah. And it's not, there's no violence in it, almost no violence. And it's just unsettling. And then they also have that weird Jodie Foster movie about that little girl that like loves by herself.
The girl down the lane or whatever.
Yeah, that's, and I don't know what that was.
Is like a child molester.
Yeah, which I guess it's a child molester. Movie,
but it's,
it's not like a, there's nothing slasher about it though.
It's tense.
And yeah.
Yeah.
I guess if it, I think we have to look at it more kind of like stepping back and away from like the horror of just, you know, the creepiness or the horror of just being. And didn't they also have that Vincent Price movie with the, what was it, the skeletons and the floating heads at the beginning? What is that called?
Oh, House on Haunted Hill?
Is that it? We're, spoiler alert, turns out it's like not.
Oh, the,
it's not actually haunted. It's him messing with people.
Oh, that's what,
oh my god, okay.
It's either The Haunting or House on Haunted Hill. I always confuse them.
It might be House on Haunted Hill. But that in itself isn't slashery or bloody really either. It's just, it's all tricks. Nothing's really real.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting thinking about like what makes the genre horror is interesting. Like just yesterday, me and Jen watched Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And people can, and it's a great film, but people consider that a horror film. And I think by today's standards, you wouldn't call it a horror film, even though there is like at least one murder. So it's just, it's interesting. It's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah. I guess you'd say more of it like as a whole. It's like, what does horror mean? And what does horror mean in different time periods?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
slashers are very relatively recent, right? It's like what, 80s?
Right.
Right. So, yeah.
So, at the end, they are, she's being chased and the, they're outside in the rain and I forget what happens, but like the storefront cracks and Rumi sees her real reflection. Oh no, Mima snatches Rumi's wig and she's now sees herself as who she is. And she's like looking at her reflection and she leans in and basically stabs herself in the chest because she's so out of it.
Oh, that was brutal.
And then she like walks into the street and she's about to be hit by a truck. And in movies, truck drivers never see, they can't stop it when they see a person. They just honk the horn and kill you. And so, but Mima actually saves her, like grabs her and jumps. And in the end, Rumi's alive in a, like a mental hospital, and Mima even brings her like flowers, and Rumi looks in her reflection and she sees like pop idol Mima. Like she's totally gone into that. She just is that person now. Like the way at the end of Psycho, like Norm Bates is just mother.
Mm-hmm.
And as she's leaving the hospital, like a couple of the nurses see Mima and they're like, oh my God, is that her? Can that really be her? And then she gets into her car and she looks in her rearview mirror and she's like, oh, I'm real. I guess tying a bow in the whole motif of like, what is real, what is not.
And also accepting her new identity. It's like she's able to violently, well, she didn't do it. I mean, but the Mima persona was stabbed, right? Like in that, right. In that sense, it's like, it's a separation.
Yeah.
So it's like she was killed away from her. And now Mima can be Mima, the actress.
And
Mima, the adult or whatever we want to read it.
In some ways, Rumi did her a favor because that manager was always never going to really listen to her. He was always going to be like this controlling father figure. And now she seems more in control of her life.
I mean, that's what we can assume. Like, and we have to, because they don't give us any more. There's only so much of this movie we can keep watching. Because we don't know who takes it, who's her like, actors need managers. We don't know. So we don't know if that person's shitty, but it seems like she has more of a, like a hold of herself. In the scene, after the rape scene, she's wearing all black, and it's almost like mourning. It's like she was violently removed from Mima, but still Mima is still a part of her. And then now at the end of the movie, she's not wearing black anymore, and it's all sunny, and she's like in this car. So it's like she has more agency, and the color change is kind of like representing that she's more herself and she's in a better place.
Yeah, it's not, there's less reds and hot colors. Someone on IMDb was like, that's why it's called Perfect Blue, because it's the only blue sky. And it's like, I don't believe you, person writing trivia. And
well, I know that You know, I didn't until I looked at the Wikipedia, I didn't actually know that this is based on a novel.
Yeah.
That is, you know, similar stuff happening, but this is way darker than that, whatever that novel was.
Yeah.
But I think the novel was called Perfect Blue.
Yeah.
So maybe, like, I don't know, maybe there's something like in the novel or about the novel that we just don't get here.
Right. I mean, it's a cool name. Mm-hmm. You know what this film reminded me of? There's a film that came out last year called Spencer with Kristen Stewart in it. And she plays Princess Diana, but it's not a biopic by any means. And it's not trying to be realistic by any means. It's like one of these psychological horror films, but with a real historical figure. And in it, it takes place over one weekend over like Christmas.
Oh.
And it's in the heights of her, and this is what happened in real life, her struggling with her eating disorder. And her and Charles kind of breaking apart, her knowing that Charles was secretly having an affair with Camilla. But like in it, she's like, all of these things are happening. Like she's seeing like the ghosts of queens of the past come to her. She's like having nightmares. All of this weird, surreal shit is happening. It's a really interesting. I don't think a lot of people liked it because I think people were looking for like a Princess Diana biopic and not this psychological horror with her. But it reminded me of this. It's actually a really cool movie.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
I'd rather have the psychological like take on it than something real. I don't care.
Yeah.
About the royal family. We fought a whole war, so we don't have to care about them anymore. Why do we keep caring about them?
I know.
And let me get off my soapbox.
I know. Well, everyone go and watch this. It's very good.
Mike, thanks for having me here. This was fun, and I'm really glad that we got to like watch this movie and talk about it, because it's just such an interesting, animation wise it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And duality wise if you like that, those kind of movies that deal with the psychological splitting of two,
yeah,
it's great in that sense too. Even though we spoiled it for you, just go in it for the enjoyment. Don't worry about spoilers. Who cares?
Believe me, it would be spoiled too, because you're gonna figure it out in the first fucking second. You immediately figure it out. It didn't ruin it for me. All right. That's Nadia Kater. Nadia, we end every episode by saying
go bye-bye.